Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Later in the hour, we talk with astrophysicist Mario Livio about the parallels between science deniers today and in the time of Galileo. But first, a wondrous tale about how to persevere in a world where chaos will always prevail. Why Fish Don't Exist by Lulu Miller is part biography, part memoir, part scientific adventure about the life of David Starr Jordan. Lulu Miller, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
When did David Starr Jordan come onto your radar screen?
Man, I was in my early 20s, and the story of him, a part of his story, was mentioned as I was getting a tour of a science museum, the Cal Academy of Sciences, and it was just this little detail about how after the earthquake of 1906, when all his specimen, he was a fish collector, and all hundreds of fish specimen were shattered, he, instead of just kind of giving up, he started this strange practice of tying labels directly to the fish. And it was just this odd detail that a normal person should totally forget and move on with their life. But it sort of wormed its way into my soul, and I started wondering what became of him and if he was, what kind of person he was. So yeah, it was a random anecdote, you know, over 15 years ago that really, really changed the course of my life.
I had never heard of him before I picked up this book. And as I started reading, I thought, wow, what an interesting guy. I could see why you would want to know more about him. There's so much in his life. So let's talk a little bit about his childhood and his desire for order in this chaotic world really started young.
Really young, almost as soon as he could see the world, that he talks about how he couldn't quite enjoy the beauty, the twinkling of the stars, because they bothered him and he wanted to know their names. And so he set out on this five-year quest to learn the name of every star in the sky. And once he felt he knew their names, then he could be at peace with them. And after he'd mastered the sky, he turned to the ground and he started trying to learn the scientific name of every flower. And that was just something, you know, that went on in his life. And the world around him was actually kind of hostile to this hobby. His mom threw away early collections. His teachers told him it was a waste of time. He couldn't get a job. He couldn't get a girl. But he just kept needing to know the names for things. And that once he'd sort of mastered flowers and plants, he turned to fish, which would become his obsession for the rest of his life, just because the ocean and the water is so, you know, unfathomably deep.
Yeah, obsession's a good word for it, too. Now, talk about the impact that Penakis Island had on him.
Oh, my gosh. This is a massive pivot point in his story. So he's, as a kid, his early 20s, again, he's just obsessed with doing this. But everyone tells him it's wasteful and it's just a hobby and it's pointless. And it's in the summer of 1873. He goes out to Penakis. Louis Agassiz, the famous Swiss naturalist, has just started a kind of summer camp for naturalists out there, which once I learned about the history of Penakis was so interesting to me, because it really has for centuries been this odd little treeless place, as your listeners probably know, but I didn't. That's been this kind of outpost for hope, whether it was the leper colony or a heroin recovery center or the school for, you know, for boys struggling in school. It's always been this weird little place that people try to like protect vulnerable populations and give them a shot. And in the 1870s, that vulnerable population was naturalists, because it was sort of falling out of fashion at that time to study nature by looking at nature. Instead, you know, professors, you know, academia wanted professors to be really charming and quote recitations from books. And so anyway, sorry, long ramp up there. But Louis Agassiz started this camp where he would teach scientists to look at nature directly. And his sort of motto was study nature, not books. And David Starr Jordan found his way there. And it was there he was told that looking at nature was, quote, missionary work of the highest order. And Agassiz believed that in every single species was a thought of God, and to study nature would be to eventually glean the divine plan, this sort of hierarchy in nature that could tell us something about God's preferences and judgments and higher and beliefs. And so that it was like Jordan himself would eventually let go of that idea, because he you know, came to believe in Darwin and evolution, but he still believed in this idea of a hierarchy carved by time. And it was there on the island that he first got this sense that what he was doing mattered. And I cannot tell you, like, after leaving that summer, his life just takes this rapid ascent, and he gets a job. He becomes the president of Indiana University. He then is asked to come be the first president of Stanford University. And I think there's kind of a lesson there that, you know, he had other connections. He was a white man in the 1870s. There were other reasons he ascended so quickly. But I do think having this sense of purpose can really make a difference in a life. And that's what he really got at Penikese.
Yeah, he also got a girl.
He did get a girl, perhaps even more important. there was this botanist from Massachusetts, from out in the Berkshires, Susan Bowen, who had auburn hair. And, I think there wasn't too much on the paper trail, but there were these little things about how there's not much there, but he does talk about how they would walk around, and I believe that she showed him bioluminescence for the first time. He had never seen the ocean until that summer when he was 22, and she was into plants and botany, and she kind of showed him, you know, if you toss a rock into the waves on the right night, you get this little firework show, and they would eventually, years later, get married.
Hmm. Now, it's what's interesting about this book is it's kind of part history, part memoir. And as I can see this little, as you mentioned, the little quirkiness that got you interested in David Starr Jordan. But as you're going through this, you find some parallels, I think. And I'm wondering if you talk about the impact your father had on you when you asked him about the meaning of life.
Yeah. So this is kind of, a thing that has haunted me for a long time. So I was a little girl. I was actually in Wellfleet and was looking out at the marsh, looking out at the bay with my dad early in the morning. I was about 7. And I don't know what it was. It was like the place where the water meets the sky. And I suddenly wondered, what's a horizon? What's out there? What are we all doing here? And I kind of asked him, what's the meaning of life? And he just paused for a second and then said, nothing. And there's no point, there's no plan, there's no God, there's no afterlife, and we're all as insignificant to the planet as an ant. And if you zoom out from space, we're smaller than a speck, we're just a speck on a speck on a speck, and we'll be dead soon, and we were made by chaos, and nothing we do matters. And it was this, like, he's a very joyful person, and so I remember feeling a little scared, like, oh, then what are we all doing here? But then I also remember thinking, okay, well, if I believe these things, I'll turn out as happy and ebullient as him. But then there, you know, and some days that really is empowering. Carpe diem, if it doesn't matter, you know, whatever, just live and take risks. But I think as I grew older and I saw certain cruelties in the world, to my oldest sister who had some differences, and then just to me, typical high school stuff, it just sometimes would haunt me, like, if nothing matters, then why stay and endure the pain? And I think it kind of, I'm probably already an oversensitive person, but that thought just became like a really dark one on some days. And so weirdly, looking to Jordan, this random ichthyologist, this guy, this scientist, I think I was looking to him to understand how he had so much optimism and resilience in his life, even when the worst things happen, like when chaos, destroys 30 years of his life's work in one instant. Like, where did he find that resolve to just keep going and to, in fact, invent a new way of storing his fish, which he believed would insulate his work from chaos? And that was, this odd specific question for me that actually, the more and more I wrote, I realized had these kind of deep emotional roots. And after a lot of tinkering, I finally put some of that in the book.
Yeah. Now, his resiliency is amazing. Now, you're talking about the San Francisco earthquake in 1906 that destroyed his work, but that wasn't the first time. He overcame other obstacles that would have destroyed other people. The fire in the lab in 1883 destroyed everything. But he didn't despair. He went right back out there recollecting. And his brother dies, and his beloved daughter and wife. I mean, this guy just keeps getting back up.
It's amazing. And I think that was, as I started to look into his story, right. So his first collection is struck by lightning and burns to the ground. And he was so uncannily plagued by chaos. To me, it almost, he almost leapt off the page for me as a parable. Like, I don't happen to believe in God or cosmic justice or anything, but he almost was like this parable for the heathens where chaos, my ruler, just kept messing with him and he just kept going utterly unfazed. And people wrote about him. A colleague said, you know, no matter how bad the day, he could always be found a humming, a tune, a down the arcade. And he talks about how he's always had this shield of optimism and how, like, you know, failure and, you know, misfortune never got him down. And so that was really, you know, I say a parable, like I learned all these details. And what I started to wonder was, okay, if you are that optimistic, are you made a fool by the end? Or do you need a little bit of self-delusion almost, or just uncanny optimism simply to make it in this world? And so, like, I actually set out starting to research him to figure out the ending. You know, was he an Icarus who just flew too close to the sun and would be humiliated by the sheer power of the forces of chaos? Or did he end up triumphant? And so that was kind of like the question that really launched me down this rabbit hole of his life.
We're talking with Lulu Miller about her book, Why Fish Don't Exist. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Lulu Miller about her book, Why Fish Don't Exist, which is part biography, part memoir, part scientific adventure about the life of David Starr Jordan. You mentioned him becoming the president of Stanford. Talk about his relationship with the Stanfords and his thoughts on the death of Jane Stanford.
Yes. So he was excited to take the job at Stanford because of the nice weather. He was also wanted to be close to the ocean, much better fish hunting out there than in Indiana. But he was nervous about what he considered the moral and intellectual inferiority of the Stanfords. Leland Stanford, they were, you know, incredibly rich. Leland Stanford was widely considered a robber baron. He was involved in politics. He'd been a Republican senator. And Jane Stanford was really into seances and mediums to try to contact their dead son. And so he looked down on both of them and he was worried about being controlled by them. Leland Stanford died within the first year of Stanford's opening. And so then Jane really became his main boss. And as the years grew, they really started to have conflicts. She kind of accused him of nepotism, of only hiring his friends. She said he was spending too much time on his fish. She wanted him to start a center for parapsychology at Stanford, which he thought was ludicrous. So they really clashed. And then mysteriously, just as rumors were circulating that she was going to fire him, she died. And she died mysteriously while traveling in Hawaii. And for a long time, it was said that she died of natural causes. But about 10 years ago, a historian at Stanford started looking more deeply and discovered, first of all, that 2 months before she died, there'd been a poisoning attempt on her life, and that the reason she actually died had been initially ruled a poisoning out in Hawaii. And so he looked at all the records, and it really appears she was poisoned. There was strychnine found in her medicine jar and in her stomach. She died within 30 minutes of these intense convulsions. And so it really looks like she was poisoned, and there's a very good paper trail of David Starr Jordan rushing out to Hawaii to quash the idea to cover up that it was a poisoning. And he did a lot of work to make it appear as though it was a natural death. And so, you know, I don't know. I think there are professors and scholars who've speculated maybe Jordan ordered the death or was some kind of assassin, you know, from a distance, or maybe he just, for some other reason, wanted to cover up her death. But the timing is very mysterious. And there, as he got older, he had an incredibly ruthless streak for kind of striking out against anyone who got in the way of his goals. So that is it's still a mystery, but it's certainly a troubling part of his story.
Talk about troubling. So here's a scientist who became president of Stanford University, a man you admired, and then you learn he was a proponent of eugenics. Tell us about that and the impact it had on your feelings for him.
Yeah, and not just a little bit. So a lot of scientists, unfortunately, became involved in the eugenics movement David Starr Jordan was one of the earliest and loudest proponents. As I started looking into his old syllabi and strange places, you'd see him tucking it into lectures, saying that things like poverty or feeble-mindedness, as it was called in the day, which was kind of a code for either promiscuity or, you know, just low scores on intelligence tests, things like that. He said that those traits could be exterminated. And as he grew, he used his prestige and his power to really sort of try to legitimize and give a background for eugenics and push to put all these eugenic sterilization laws on the books, some of which are actually more with us today than I think most people realize. It's the Supreme Court ruling that allowed for the eugenic sterilization of anyone in the United States has never been overturned. That decision has never been overturned. But he, I mean, the more I started seeing his writing on this and just his utter certainty that, you know, he'd say things like education can never replace heredity and that there are some people who are, quote, unfit, who don't deserve to live. It was just the more I saw that stuff, I just wanted to throw my hands off him. You know, here was someone I'd been looking as sort of a North Star, and I just thought, oh no, is this where optimism leads you? And I think, you know, one of the main sins I see in his story isn't just the bad idea. Like, there are reasons his science led him to this horrible idea of eugenics. Where I see the sin is when he didn't let go, because there was more and more opposition, scientific and moral, to the idea of eugenics. And he just dug in and he just grew more and more certain that this was the way to heal society. And it's sad, you know, he started out as someone dedicated to the hidden and insignificant. And he ended up as someone who wanted to rid the hidden and insignificant from this earth. And so then I just had to, in certain ways, just think, well, okay, this isn't, you know, I had to let go of him and say, well, maybe I don't want to be like this. But I think, honestly, I guess at the very end, you know, sort of toward the end of the last couple of years of my researching process was when I started to treat it more like journalism and not try to read him as a black and white character to provide me with moral instruction and look at the complexity in his tale. And so I do think he's mostly a cautionary tale. He ends up being a horrific villain. And yet, every person is complex. I don't think anyone is pure evil. And I think there are still a few lessons that are positive that we can learn from him, which is hard to say, but I think is true and sort of does speak to the moment right now where we just, so many of us, find so much of our lives upended.
Yeah. I think one of the biggest surprises in the book to me was the sterilization laws.
Yeah.
First, I guess a part of history I didn't know much about, but the fact that they're still on the books is just shocking.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, many lawyers will say, OK, well, it's in a legal purgatory where it's never been overturned at the Supreme Court level, but every state has overturned its law. So in that way, like, no one could ever actually get sterilized. But then I talk to more and more people who are disabled. These are who these laws primarily targeted. And they've pointed out, you know, it's about 20 to 23 states, there is ambiguity where they're not using the word if you're unfit. Now they use words like intellectually disabled or incompetent. There's different words, but there still is a legal groundwork to sterilize someone against their will for the good of society. And that's the distinction. Like, if it would be in your own best interest, in theory, to sterilize you for your own health, you know, maybe there could be a reason there. But there are still states which allow for the sterilization if it's in the best interest of society, which is, you know, that's eugenics. That's a eugenics mindset right there. And so it's more alive. And in some of my reporting, you know, I talk to people who are living, who have been sterilized against their will. And there are more people out there, I think, you know, certainly than I had any clue when I started going into this.
Yeah. You write, what David Starr Jordan set in motion by practicing the art of taxonomy, by following Darwin's advice to sort creatures by evolutionary closeness, led to a fateful discovery. In the 1980s, taxonomists realized that fish, as a legitimate category of creatures, do not exist. Birds exist, mammals exist, amphibians exist, but fish, in particular, do not exist.
Yes.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and it took me years of reading and years of writing to kind of finally write the chapter where I try to explain this in human terms. But basically the idea is that fish, when you look very closely at them, there are creatures in the water. For example, lungfish look exactly like a trout or a salmon. It's a very fishy looking fish, scaly, looks like a fish. But if you look under its scales, and you'll see it has what's called an epiglottis, which is a little flap that goes over the throat, and it has very similar organs to lungs, and it has a heart that's more closely shaped to the heart of a mammal. And when you start to see this, you know, any scientist, this is not controversial, will say, a lungfish is more closely related to a mammal, to us, to cows, you know, things like that. And when you start, there are all these things that when you aren't distracted by almost the costume of fishiness, there's so much more complexity and nuance down in the water. And fish is basically a gerrymandered category. The way that we use it, which is to say that everything down there belongs to the same class, it's just completely inaccurate. Since the 80s, it's been widely accepted in, you know, the scientific circles that care about how to properly order the, you know, creatures on Earth. It's not a controversial idea that fish is a totally illegitimate category. But that idea, I think, matters because to me it's a proxy of what else might we have wrong. You know, I talk a lot about in the book this concept of an unfit person, someone who doesn't deserve to live for certain reasons. I think in that way fish and unfit are similar in that they are very sober, simple words that we just trust. But I kind of use the fish don't exist as an example to remind us to mistrust the categories around us, especially those that, you know, talk about the moral or intellectual quality of a person. I think we need to be really wary of those and just basically walk around with a little more curiosity about, do we believe in that category and who made it? And are we sure that everything we say about the people who exist under it is true? And so that's sort of, you know, I try to, for the science nerds out there, I try to like explain really clearly how scientists came to this discovery and what it means. But then the very end of the book is kind of how that understanding, once I've finally accepted it for myself, has made a difference in my actual life.
I love this paragraph. You write, what other truths are waiting behind the lines we draw over nature? What other categories are about to cave in? Could clouds be animate? Who knows? On Neptune, it rains diamonds. It really does. Scientists figured that out just a few years ago. The longer we examine our world, the stranger it proves to be.
Yeah.
I did not know that it rains diamonds on Neptune.
Isn't that fascinating?
Fascinating fact.
Yeah, the pressure is so high in the air that under certain conditions, the carbon molecules literally crystallize and turn into diamonds. I mean, it's, you know, there's so much. I think it's just, you know, one of my essential, you know, emotional struggles, you know, something that I felt since a little kid was just this idea that the world is totally bleak, it's meaningless, it's pointless, and everything's known. And this is almost an antidote for that. It reminds me that, like, we still know so little. There is still so much more that we can't even fathom, that we don't understand. And whether it's a beautiful natural factoid or surprise, or whether it's about the kind of person we could fall in love with or like, or, you know, there's just, if we let ourselves be surprised by the world, it just has endless tricks up our sleeve. And that's been something that, for me, has authentically sort of warmed the bleakness of it all.
And being that open to surprise, and I don't want to give away everything in the book, but when you finally let yourself do that, you do find the love of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And it came in a form I was not expecting at all. And I think that authentically, the sort of nerdy, obsessive work I had done thinking about scientific categories and their flimsiness and their pointlessness at times, or their danger, I think that that actually paved the groundwork for me to sort of accept a totally different life than what I'd ever imagined for myself. And now, you know, 7 years later, it's like, it's so much richer and happier than the like lost and lonely me could have ever seen. So yeah, I do think this stuff can actually have like real world effects, as abstract as it sort of seems.
So what is it that you hope readers take away from this book?
You know, I hope that it gives a sense of wonder. And wonder, I think, is a word that gets, you know, tossed around. It has sparkles and it seems like it's for kids and it's a twee word. But I actually think wonder is about, you know, the root of awe actually comes from terror, to stand before something so big you can't comprehend it. And what I hope it gives people is just a sense that there's more waiting out there for them than they might fear on their worst days. And, you know, I do let myself go into some of the darker places. And I hope that there could be a sense of, I think, if anything, just communion of, hey, some other weirdo brooding about some of these things too, offering some strange delights. But at its base, I hope it's just a good ride. I mean, it's mostly just kind of a, what I hope reads like a little bit like a thriller of this guy's wildlife.
Lulu Miller's book is Why Fish Don't Exist, A Story of Loss, Love, and the Hidden Order of Life. Lulu, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.